Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, back in studio, and today on the program, we've got a lot of politics. The seemingly endless election cycle, it turns out, does have an end date. We'll look at the Clinton and Trump campaigns in Utah, also the 4th District race, the sudden departure of a candidate in the race for Attorney General, and to round things out, the battle over the bear's ears. Joining me in studio this morning, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Robert Gerke. Thanks, Robert, for being here.
Thank you.
Government reporter Matt Canham. Thanks for being here as well.
Hello.
Tribune editorial writer George Pyle is here as well. Thanks and welcome.
Good morning.
And joining us via the phone is Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent Thomas Burr. Tommy, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
Listeners, you can join this conversation with your comments and questions at sltrib.com or call us up at 801-355-TALK. Again, that's 801-355-8255. Matt Canham, you reported on Donald Trump Jr.'s visit to Utah. This was, to shore up support for his dad in the state. Before we get to the visit, how is the Republican candidate, Donald Trump Sr., doing here in the polls?
So the polls we've seen so far in Utah have shown that he has a lead, but that he's not exactly liked. In fact, there's a big chunk of Utah that finds him distasteful. That's not just Democrats, but also Republicans. And that's why you see Donald Trump so far behind what we've seen in other Republican presidential candidates in Utah. We're used to Republican candidates being in the 60s or the 70 percentile range, and we've seen him more in the 30s and early 40s. So we'll see if that changes as things go on. We've also seen that third-party candidates here tend to do better than they are in other states. That would include Libertarian Gary Johnson and Independent Conservative Evan McMullen have pulled better here, and it's in large part because there's Republicans looking for an alternative to Trump.
Okay. In that context, Trump Jr. comes to town, and as he arrived, he was facing some criticism for something that he tweeted, I guess like father, like son. Tell us about the Skittles tweet.
So he sent a tweet that's a picture of a small bowl of Skittles, and it says that if I – it's something to the effect of, if I told you that that three of these were poisonous, would you take a handful? That's our problem with the Syrian refugees. It's equating candy to an individual who is, you know, trying to flee a war zone, for one, but also simplifies it to the fact that people made fun of it, that you could use the same argument about guns or about anything in society. If I told you that three people die from a TV falling over on them, would you buy a TV? Mm. I mean, so it became something easily mocked.
Reductionist. Trump Sr. has previously said that he has a problem in the state of Utah. And part of that has been chalked up to his hardline stance on immigration, on refugees in a state where we have a lot of international ties. Was there any specific, Utah-specific blowback from that tweet?
So he... Donald Trump Jr. did ask participate in some interviews, not with the Salt Lake Tribune, but with the Deseret News, with the Doug Wright Show, with KUTV. And in two of those, he was asked about the Skittles tweet in relation to, as you just said, that Utah is more accepting of Syrian refugees than every other Republican-led state in the nation. And the LDS Church, even this week, put out a video about how we should extend a warm welcome to refugees. And Donald Trump Jr. didn't back down. He said he thinks it's an issue. He doesn't think there's good vetting, and that he points to what's happening in Europe, where there's far less control over what refugees enter those countries, as an example of bad things that could happen if we let people from this area of the country come here. Now, his issue is that there are not good – he doesn't believe there's good enough information on who these people are and what their intentions are when they come here. And that's because Syria is under an extensive civil war, that they don't have the records that we would need. But
which is why people, of course, are leaving the country.
Well, and that's also kind of a problem with refugees in every place where there's refugees. If you look at South Sudan, it's not like there's a lot of government records on every person who lives in the South Sudan or Burma or anywhere else in which we get refugees. This is a persistent problem. The difference is there are extremists who have infiltrated Syria. There's ISIS there. That's the concern. How do you weed out people who are just trying to, you know, survive than those who have ill intents? And they're arguing that our system does not do that well, while Hillary Clinton and President Obama says are arguing that our system does fine.
And Governor Herbert, too, actually. Governor Herbert has been sort of broke ranks with Republican governors earlier in the year and said that we were going to take some of these refugees from these other places. Obviously, this sort of puts him at odds with the nominee.
That's Robert Gerke. George Pyle from the editorial desk, your take on the Skittles tweet before we move on to what Donald Trump Jr. actually did while he was here.
Well, it's another illustration of how, you know, the people who like Donald Trump really like Donald Trump. And after the Skittles tweet, they like him even more. And the people who hate Donald Trump really hate Donald Trump, and they hate him even more after this tweet. A lot of social media is just bunk, but I thought there was some really heartfelt responses to this, some of them with language that I'm not going to repeat on the radio, but saying that you cannot compare candies to human beings, and a very heartfelt thing that went viral about how, hell yes, I'd eat the Skittles. These are human beings. And if I ate one of the poison ones, that's the price you pay for being a decent human being when there are all these people who are in this state, and they've traced it back, and I don't know how reliable this is, but they've traced it back, you know, three poisoned Skittles. Before that, it was three poisoned M&Ms. Right. Before that, it was three poisoned mushrooms. It's been traced back to a Nazi who was hanged at Nuremberg for war crimes, and this is the genesis of this analogy. So, this is getting pretty nasty.
Well, I want to just send out a quick reminder to listeners that you are welcome to join this conversation with your calls at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Maybe we should turn away from the tweet and find out what Trump Jr. actually did while he was here. Matt Canham, what was the purpose of his visit, I guess, was to try and, yes, gain more support for his father.
Actually, the purpose of his visit was to raise money for his father. And the other part was kind of ancillary. He came for a fundraiser at a house in Bountiful owned by a real estate investor. It was $10,000 to be a sponsor, $2,700 to get in. The idea is that the Trump campaign, even though they're not ever going to match Hillary Clinton in fundraising, still need enough to compete. And you got to go where people can raise money, which is why we also saw Indiana Governor Mike Pence make a visit. Wouldn't be surprised if we see other people come here to try to raise some money to keep these ads going, to keep this machine going in the last 45 days we have in this election. So while he was here, he also made a series of visits. He did some media interviews, as I said. He's also met with some prominent Utahns to shore up support. But each step of the way, he tried to really emphasize that they're not worried about Utah. They don't want it to seem like they're concerned that they might lose this state. He kept saying that this was him keeping his word on coming here.
Well, we still have a group of Utah Republicans, though, including, you know, members of Congress who have said, they've either said that they won't vote for Trump or that they haven't yet decided whether they're going to vote for him. Is that right?
Yes. We have some very prominent people like Senator Mike Lee, Representative Mia Love, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, who clearly have a lot of distaste for the campaign Donald Trump has run to this point. They're not closing the door on voting for him completely, but they're not liking what they're seeing, and so they're not saying who they're going to vote for.
Okay, well, Trump is ahead in the polls here nonetheless, but Democrats still think he's vulnerable. Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent Thomas Burr, this week the Clinton campaign unveiled a new Utah-based group of supporters. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the group is called I was eating some Skittles. The group's called Mormons for Hillary, and it has about 600 people, I think, involved when they launched it. And the effort is Hillary's. I think the Clinton campaign knows that Utah's a pretty big stretch to win, but they want to make Trump earn it. So these efforts are all based on the idea that at least we'll try to woo the Mormon vote. And in this case, we have people like David Irvine, the former Brigadier General and former chairman of the Davis County Republican Party, who is part of the Mormons for Hillary group. A bunch of other people you might recognize, Kim Gardner, who's a Democrat, a big Romney friend, is part of this group. It's small, but it's starting. I will note, just for the record, though, that there's a Facebook group, Mormons for Trump, that has like 20, 21,000 followers. So they're a little behind on the Hillary Mormons for Hillary group.
What's how I think you said, but how big is the Mormons for Hillary Facebook group again?
They have about 600 supporters, I think, versus the 20, 21,000 that the Mormons for Trump group is.
So, I mean, Utah gets called the reddest state in the nation sometimes. It's the most Republican state, and much of that is attributed to its Mormon makeup. This is kind of rehashing what we've gone over, but Trump isn't struggling as much with Mormon voters as I'm sure Democrats would like him to be struggling. Can a group like this have an effect with just 6 weeks left to go before the election? I don't know, George Pyle or Tommy.
Yeah, it's a pretty big ask, I would say, from this side. It's kind of a really hard effort to convince people who are conditioned and used to voting for Republican candidates and have voted Republican most of their lives to change their minds. This group is obviously going to, you know, try to do the over the backyard, you know, over the back fence kind of conversations and pull people aside after church and talk to them about this. But it's a pretty hard move to take somebody who is used to and you know, adopts the values of the Republican Party to then vote for a Democrat. Not necessarily not vote for Trump, but vote for a Democrat. That's the bigger ask.
And I guess so. This is party affiliation playing a hand. But early on, it seemed as though Trump was going to have more of a difficult time here than the polls seem to show. Anybody want to comment on that?
Well, I would say that the Hillary Clinton campaign hasn't given up here. That they are still sending surrogates, including today the governor of Colorado, Hickenlooper, is going to be here for an event. They're rolling out these, you know, probably third-tier surrogates. I don't want to be critical, but they're obviously not
the B list of actors.
Right, you're not getting Joe Biden here, but you're getting the governor of Colorado just to try to get enough excitement that they're not saying it's not possible at this stage. Actually, I've seen watching some football games last weekend on cable. There were some Hillary Clinton ads. I haven't seen any Donald Trump ads here, and so they haven't given up completely. But I think that's also a sense that they know this is a hard ask in Utah.
Well, it's also that, I mean, the Mormon vote isn't only in Utah. It's mostly in Utah, but there are Mormons in Nevada, there are Mormons in Idaho, there are Mormons in Arizona, where those are much closer in the polls. Those are potential swing states. And so it is, I mean, Mormons for Hillary and Mormons for Donald aren't just Utahns. There are other states as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of politics to discuss on the show today, including coming up a bit of a September surprise in the race for Utah Attorney General. But at the moment, we have to take our first break. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined in studio by the Salt Lake Tribune's Robert Gerke, Matt Canham, George Pyle, and also via the phone by Thomas Burr. You can join the conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com or calling us at 801-355-8255. As I mentioned before we went to the break, there was a surprising announcement this week in the race for state attorney general. Robert Gerke, incumbent Sean Reyes, was already in a pretty good position, but now I guess he's in a particularly good spot.
Right. It looks like he's going to pretty much waltz in. It's the Democrat, John Harper, who was running against him and trailing him badly. But the most recent poll had him trailing by about 43 points, I believe. Dropped out of the race is just unexpectedly and pretty abruptly. And so this means Sean, you know, now is essentially unopposed and, is pretty much headed, guaranteed to re-elect another term.
Harper cited health reasons. That can mean any number of things. Did he disclose what those health concerns were?
No, and he's kind of been off the radar a little bit. So other than saying that on the advice of his physician, he's getting out of the race, he's he hasn't disclosed anything further about that.
You said he was trailing the polls. What kind of a race was he running? And I guess what kind of a chance did he have?
He had very little chance, I think. He had a popular, reasonably popular incumbent who was polling at about 60%, and then you had Harper down in the teens. It was an uphill battle for him. He was having a hard time raising money, certainly not raising nearly as much as the incumbent was. And then, it was sort of below the radar. The interesting thing, I guess, on Tuesday night, he was supposed to be going down for a fundraiser down in St. George that he decided not to go to, I guess. Sort of left people sitting around waiting for him to show up, including his campaign manager. And that's when he told her, well, don't take any more checks. I'm dropping out. The next day was supposed to be the debate between the two, between Reyes and Harper. And of course, that turned into just Reyes answering questions from the audience and from the panelists.
Okay, sort of town hall. You wrote about a libertarian candidate, Andrew McCullough, mm-hmm. rushing to St. George in the hopes of debating Sean Reyes. That obviously didn't happen.
Yeah, I think Andy was going to be down there anyway, trying to meet and greet people outside the debate hall. Andy has run for attorney general. I believe this is his fourth time. And he sees this as a window of opportunity, not just for himself, but for the Libertarian Party. He thinks that, now those people who maybe were supporting Harper before might take another look at the Libertarian candidate. And he says he's going to start campaigning harder. He was hoping that they would allow him to debate. The debate commissions has this threshold where you have to get 10% in order to qualify, and McCullough was around 5.5. So he wasn't allowed to debate. And he was frustrated by that. I think he said it would make more sense to have two people on the stage and have competing ideas out there. But the debate commission said, well, our rules are the rules. And we had other people that were polling about 5%. We're not going to let them in just because. That's okay. Where that one stands. So McCullough is going to make a run at it. Again, it's unlikely that he's going to be able to pull even.
George Pyle from the editorial desk, I'm kind of wondering, so Harper drops out because of health reasons. Does this say anything about the organization of the Democratic Party in Utah or its own competitiveness here?
Yeah, it's pretty sad. He was in to see us before he dropped out, obviously, to see the editorial board. We're doing interviews of candidates for the statewide offices and Congress, and he had what we thought were some good ideas and some good platforms. But at the same time, now looking back, knowing what we know now, he didn't seem like maybe his heart was fully in it. We just put it down to the fact that he was running an uphill race in a Republican state, and we've talked about how surprising it is that Donald Trump isn't leading, with 70% of the vote. That's so surprising in this state. But it is kind of a spiral. I mean, the Republicans win. They win big. Next election, who wants to be the Democratic candidate? Nobody. So then what happens? The Republicans win big. It's like trying, you've got a losing football program and you can't recruit. Maybe they ought to put in a draft or something so that we can even this up a little bit. The Democrats, Sean Reyes, after the Shurtleff and Swallow business, I mean, maybe he's just seen as so much better compared to them. But you also might have run at it in a way that says, well, like Ford was vulnerable after Nixon. Maybe Reyes would be vulnerable after Swallow. Well, apparently not. And the Democrats, I would argue they don't have a serious candidate for county mayor against Ben McAdams. That's Republican side. They've just decided they're not even going to run at that one. So you look at Ben McAdams and you say, well, he's running really well. They don't even challenge him. Maybe he would run for Congress. Maybe he would run for governor. And then we look at him again and we say, he's too smart to even try that. It's just Republicans just have a lock on these things.
Just briefly on that, I mean, you look across the board at these polls and the Democrats are polling on average probably 35 points behind their Republican opponents. And then you have candidates dropping out. You have candidates not—you had a House candidate last week who dropped out, and then the Attorney General candidate. It's a real problem for the party right now that they don't have a very deep bench, and they're having a hard time recruiting people. And in a year where, as we were discussing, there's some opportunities out there for them to make some inroads, they've really failed to do that.
Well, and I want to talk about some additional races, ahead. But listeners, I just want to remind you that you can join this conversation with your calls, 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Maybe you can put up your ideal Democratic candidate to compete against somebody. But we're not done yet with politics. As I said, Matt Canham, the 4th Congressional District, has a perennially competitive race. This is the seat that Jim Matheson vacated and Mia Love won 2 years ago. We've got a rematch going between her and Democrat Doug Owens, but things all of a sudden aren't looking as competitive as they have been in the past.
That's true. The Salt Lake Tribune and the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah have a new poll out, and it shows that Mia Love has an 18 percentage point lead on Doug Owens, which was very close to what the Utah Debate Commission poll found. When that poll came out, a lot of us who cover politics were thinking, that's too high. That doesn't really make sense. As you said, this is normally a very competitive race. This is a race where the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee in Washington is funneling money to Doug Owens because they think he has a shot to win. And now this is the second poll in a row that shows a huge lead. You know, in Utah, we might be used to 30-point leads, but an 18-point lead is a massive lead.
Well, and the interesting thing about that district, too, it's a 16-point Republican advantage in that district, which means now at this point, Doug Owens is actually losing Democrats to Mia Love. And so, you know, if 18's the number, I mean, it's probably somewhere in that neighborhood. And it's hard to see exactly what's changed from 2 years ago when this was a 5-point district.
Well, I know. So this is a question. Mia Love has been running some attack ads on TV. Could that be part of I mean, is that a strategy that's working for her, I guess?
I mean, we can take a couple stabs at it. That could be part of it. Another thing is that Doug Owens is running a far less aggressive campaign this time, at least media-wise, than he did last time. Last time, he had ad after ad calling her positions extreme. She also, even though she was well-known by name, it's different than when you've actually done the job for 2 years and the world hasn't collapsed and you don't hear anything that you think is so bad that she did. Well, maybe she's fine. Maybe my concern about her wasn't as big. And that's one thing that we've noticed, that her approval ratings have always been a soft spot for her in the 40 percentile range, which is not good for an incumbent. In this poll that we did, her approval rating was, I believe, I'm going to add this up real fast, 62% said that they had a favorable view of her. That's by far the highest we've ever seen in a poll, which could mean this poll is a little bit of an outlier, or it could mean that people have warmed up to her.
Benefits of incumbency, maybe. I don't know. So you also mentioned that this has been an expensive race in the past. How about this year? You said the DCCC
is putting
some money in, and that's probably because of the thought of down ballot races in a state. Trump is running right at the top of the ticket, and people think that that Republicans lower down on the ballot might be vulnerable.
I think there's that, but there's also the fact that Doug Owens, as we said, only lost by about 7,500 votes last time, and has raised so much more money this time on his own that they thought, well, he has to have a chance. And this race might tighten up, but something's going to have to change. Our pollster is Dan Jones, and when I talked to him about it, Dan said that, you know, Doug Owens has got to stop the bleeding, and he has to turn it around soon. Like, this has to happen now. And we've seen no evidence that they're going to change strategy, though. Not yet.
So none of his own attack ads at the moment.
They said they might do that, but they haven't launched anything yet, and I would assume we'll see that, but I don't know when.
Well, when Matheson beat her, he had this precision campaign where the party, the national party, would hammer Mia Love. He'd come in behind it with a positive ad about how he's not extreme on education, and it was just, they'd just go back and forth, and it was like a combination punch. We've seen none of that this time. We've seen, you know, the DCCC's promise to put money in it, and we haven't seen that really materialize in any measurable way. And at this point, I think the national money is going to start going away, because if you can't show that this is a viable race, there's no reason for them to waste money on it.
Got to be competitive. Tommy Burr, the view from Washington on this race on whether Republicans, you know, are going to retain a majority in the House generally.
Well,
Well, it'll be interesting to see how long the DTRIP will keep funding Doug Owens. At some point, they're going to look at those polls and say they're going to put the resources somewhere else if Owens continues to lead. But, you know, I think the chattering class here in Washington would probably say that it's clear that the Republicans are going to keep control of the House. And it looks, just by looking at some of the battleground states in the Senate races, it looks like the Republicans will keep control of the Senate as well. Of course, anything could happen, and I'm stopping to predict anything this year because I didn't think Donald Trump would be the nominee at all either. So who knows what's going to happen in what, the 47 days we have left before the election?
There's still time. There's still time. Matt, Robert Gierke pointed out that, you know, previous 1-2 punch that that came from the national level, and then also Jim Matheson and his strategy. You reported that Owens is actually facing some strong criticism from a fellow Democrat. That obviously can't be helping his cause here in Utah.
It actually brings into light an internal debate within the Democratic Party that's been going on for well over a decade and probably for a generation. It's, should the Democratic Party try to moderate to get Republican or independent or Mormon votes, or should they be unabashedly liberal and show what a Democrat is? So the Senate candidate is Misty Kay Snow. She's a Bernie Sanders supporter and a very liberal person. And she falls on the different end of the scale than Doug Owens, who is a Mormon Democrat who identifies himself as an independent, maybe even a step to the conservative scale on many issues, that he's more in the Jim Matheson mold as opposed to, say, Rocky Anderson mode. And so Misty Kay Snow, in the editorial board meeting that I sat in as a reporter, was openly critical of Doug Owens as a candidate, saying he doesn't stand on any issues. He's not out there advocating for the working class people or LGBT rights. And where is he? That she said that he's a very frustrating candidate and that she's very glad she does not live in the 4th District and would have to vote in that race. But that's a debate internally that has happened for a long time.
Well, a fractured Democratic Party, you know, I guess what it takes to win maybe in Utah, as you said, kind of kowtowing or not kowtowing, but having candidates who are of a certain ilk.
You're right. And her argument is that doesn't win.
Well, it won for Jim Matheson all that time. And there were a lot of people who, Democrats, Rocky Anderson Democrats, who would look at Jim Matheson and say, he's not a Democrat. What are we doing? Well, but he wins and he lines up so that the Democrats maybe control the House or have a
caucuses.
Better thing. But Harry Truman said, if you give people a choice between a Republican and a Republican, they'll vote for Republican every time. Mm-hmm. And Misty's argument was, that's what we've got in the 4th District and maybe why Owens isn't doing so well, because he's meal of light.
Listeners, we want to hear your thoughts on this as well. Call us 801-355-TALK or comment at sltrib.com. This division or apparent division in the Democratic Party in Utah. Robert Gierke, I cut you off.
Well, the same division exists in the Republican Party. We saw it with Gary Herbert and Jonathan Johnson, you know, who's the real Republican. But it doesn't matter in the Republican Party because you can be divided and still win in this state. The Democrats, when you're trying to build the party, that's where it becomes an issue. When you're trying to, you know, generate candidates who can actually win and get a message out there or some sort of cohesive message. And then this division just sort of makes that 1,000 times more complicated.
Mm. But I mean, I guess, can a Democrat win? Can a Misty Snow type candidate actually win in Utah? Or do, you know, does any Democrat have to come that far to the right?
So Misty Snow, I asked her what her goal in this race is. And essentially, her goal was to show that anyone, regardless of their background or socioeconomic class, can get into politics and change the conversation. Implicit in that answer is a sense that winning might be a little bit of a stretch. She wants to give Senator Mike Lee a run for his money, but she can read polls. She knows that she's behind significantly. It's, you know, in the 30 percentile range. But that she wants to change the conversation, where Doug Owens is a candidate that is modeling his campaign off of Jim Matheson. Jim Matheson was the son of a governor and one of a member of a very famous family in Utah, and it might not be easy to replicate his success. He had a personality or a fan base built on his dad's legacy that would be hard for anyone, even Doug Owens, the son of a late congressman, to pull off.
And of course, as you pointed out, he faced some of the same criticisms from the left that Doug Owens is facing himself. Well, it's an interesting race to watch, and maybe not as competitive as we had imagined, but 40, how many days left before the election?
About 45.
45.
Yeah, and the ballots go out like in October 15th or something. So
in Salt Lake County.
In Salt Lake County. So, you know, get those pencils ready.
Well, we're going to have to take another quick break here on the program. But when we come back, Utahns, speaking of divisions, are divided over the proposed Bears Ears National Monument. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm KCPW producer Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Thomas Burr, Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, and George Pyle. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Thomas Burr, Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent. Some new polling by the Tribune and the Hinckley Institute shows a sharply divided state when it comes to the potential designation of a new national monument in Utah. What's the breakdown on the numbers here?
Yeah, so if we have about 43% of likely voters in Utah, according to the Tribune Hinckley Institute poll, oppose the idea of a Bears Ears National Monument, but about 40% actually support it. So it is sharply divided. It's pretty close, the 3-point margin of error. So really, we're technically about even. And that's interesting as supporters go and say, look, you know, this is obviously an issue where at least a good portion of the state wants some action on protecting bears' ears. But opponents of a national monument say, you know, this shows there is not local consensus. If 70%, if it was 80%, and then maybe you could justify President Obama using the Antiquities Act to name the national monument and say, look, we'll support it. Congressman Bishop also pointed out, and he's not necessarily wrong here, because of most of Utah's population is along the Wasatch Front, you know, area. To be statistically correct on a poll, you're going to have to poll people who don't live in San Juan County. So his point is San Juan County people do not want this monument, and it doesn't matter how many people you poll in Salt Lake County, that's not going to change.
Well, and you reported that on Wednesday of this week, some Utahns were there in the nation's capital to make arguments against this designation, the governor and others?
Yeah, exactly. The governor was here. The governor flew in. Governor Herbert met with Sally Jewell, the Secretary of the Interior Department, to try to convince her that, you know, the president needs to hold off on any monument designation while they try to proceed with the public lands initiative. And then they held a news conference outside the Capitol with five of the six members of Congress, the governor, and three Native Americans who oppose a national monument, and saying, you know, look, we've got a solution. We're trying to work it through the legislative process. Don't take any action from the Obama administration. They really just want to be on record and keep the voices out there so that they hope at least that the White House is listening and is not going to take some unilateral decision and just name, you know, Bears Ears next week on the fly.
Well, you actually kind of hinted at this in your article that Sally Jewell made some comments that seemed to suggest, or if you're, you know, if you're reading the tea leaves, might suggest that there is a national monument potentially, you know, waiting in the wings, a designation waiting. I don't know. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, I mean, when she met with Governor Herbert, I got a readout from an Interior Department official who told me that she said essentially. That there's an urgent need to protect the area. That doesn't sound like somebody who's waiting in the wings looking at this legislation and just going to bide their time. That sounds like an administration that is seeing what's happening and saying, we're not going to wait around forever. Let's not forget, Obama has, 3 months or so, 3.5 months left in office, and you know, probably won't turn down the opportunity, the last chance to do something. He's used the Antiquities Act 27, 28 times so far in his administration. It's not like he's shy about using it again.
You know, so Sally Jewell said that there was an urgent need to protect this area. You spoke with U.S. Representative Rob Bishop, who said that, this isn't an urgent need at all. He rejected that sense of urgency. He, of course, also has his own plan to deal with this region. What's going on with the public lands initiative there?
So it's actually been, you know, it's kind of fast-tracked in Congress. So they just introduced, a month or so ago, and has, like I said, it was July, but has already had a hearing, was passed out of committee yesterday, and now heads to the House floor, which is pretty quick for any piece of legislation. It's not some emergency, you know, disaster of some sort. The problem is now they only have 1 week left. The Congress is out today. They're back on Monday. They're going to work like 4 days next week and maybe 5 days, and then jet until after the election. So there really isn't much time to get this done. So that's just the start of the process. The House still has to vote. And then we've got to go over to the Senate and go through a Senate committee, Senate markup, Senate floor vote. If it even could get a vote in the Senate and get passed, then you go to the president, who's not likely to sign a bill that also would take away his authority to use the Antiquities Act in a large swath of the state. So the legislative hurdles are just tremendous right now.
Pretty big. Meanwhile, you wrote about opposition to Bishop's proposal, and especially from Native American groups here in Utah and around the West.
Yeah, there are a few Native Americans who have spoken out. Rebecca Benally, the San Juan County Commissioner, who's a Native American and Navajo, who opposes the Bears Ears National Monument, supports the Public Lands Initiative, and some others that spoke here at the news conference in Washington this week. But you have a lot of other tribes and tribal leaders. They've voted. They've got together. They've put out resolutions opposing the Public Lands Initiative and supporting a national monument. As my colleague and good friend there, Matt, pointed out, added to my story today, there was a congressman yesterday who called Benally a token Native American, which doesn't go over well when you call somebody a token anything. So Congressman Bishop has asked for Congressman Chavis, I believe, asked for an apology on that one.
Well, I guess there's nothing to do but wait and see on this, right? I mean, we can't predict whether or not the president's going to make this designation. Everybody's trying to make, I guess, very open statements and try and move the needle one direction or the other, or prevent the president from doing it, make it too politically, I guess, dangerous for him or for, I don't know, Democrats in Utah. That doesn't really make sense, does it?
Well,
at some point there's they want to be on record. The delegation wants to point out that they did everything they could possibly do to stop a national monument. So if it does happen, they're not blamed for not doing anything. So that's, you know, the reason you see the legislation moving. That's why you see the news conference and the letters and the press releases. They really want to be on record about this. But interestingly, I asked Governor Herbert while he was here in town, you know, about his meeting with the secretary and whether she gave any indication off the record, you know, just between them kind of thing. Was there any kind of, you know, a wink, wink, it's going to happen, or we're waiting, don't worry. And he said that, you know, there's only one person who makes this decision, and that's President Barack Obama.
That's the truth of it. It's an interesting one. We'll have to wait and see, I guess, just until or whether or not he makes a decision to create this monument before he leaves office. Interesting story, and thanks for your reporting on that, Thomas. Listeners, you can find it all at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, we are running low on time, but I did want to get to a story that you covered this past week after the last airing of Behind the Headlines on Friday, which was the debate between Governor Gary Herbert and his challenger, Michael Weinholz, on the Democratic side. What happened at this debate, and what kind of plans did they lay out, and how was it received?
Well, it was thrown together sort of on the fly, because Governor Herbert decided less than 24 hours before the debate that he was going to actually be able to do this. Before that, he'd declined to actually participate in this debate. It was held by the Utah League of Cities and Towns, so most of the questions were directed towards city municipal issues. It was a sometimes lively exchange. I mean, they clashed on public lands issues, where Weinholz said that he doesn't think that the state should be villainizing the federal government, that the public lands are better managed by the federal government and the state can't do it as well as they are. Governor Herbert took exception at that. I think it was a largely friendly crowd to that message. It was largely rural and predominantly Republican crowd, so they were definitely in the Herbert camp, I think, on those issues. They also mixed it up a little bit on sort of the state, the extent that the state should be telling the municipalities what to do. I mean, there was a good exchange between the two, where the state's always challenging the federal government, telling them to keep their nose out of our business. Well, the cities are like, well, how come you guys, come down and poke your nose in our business every time we try to do something? So there was an exchange over that. Weinholt said that he doesn't think it's fair for the state to be, kind of doing that. And Governor Herbert said, we need to work together, but we are going to continue to challenge the federal government. So I think by and large, it was a, Weinholtz needed to really land some punches in this debate. He's only probably going to get two chances. The next one is coming up on Monday up at Utah State University, the debate sponsored by the debate commission. This was an opportunity for him to score some points and maybe get his name out there and close the gap. It was, as it turns out, the debate was sort of low profile. I don't think he landed much, and the governor did a pretty decent job of defending his record.
And I hate to always turn back to this, but how what are the polls showing this race?
It's pretty much across the board that Governor Herbert has a 25-30 point lead. Weinholtz has been out fundraised. Governor later that day on Friday had his gala that usually brings in between $750,000 and $1 million. So again, you're seeing the Democrats, I think, struggling to get traction. And even with a candidate like Weinholtz, who's put $2.5 million of his own money in there, he's having a hard time getting his message out, I think.
Hmm. Well, lots of politics on the show. I actually want to turn to one more sort of bizarre story before we go to our underplayed stories of the week. And that's, Tommy Burr, a question for you. You reported on a sort of diplomatic flap-up that stemmed from an unusual trip taken by a local politician. This is State Senator Jim DeBacchus. We're talking about what happened in this story.
Yeah, so Senator DeBacchus flew to Tehran, to Iran, at a request of some government officials, as we understand it, and spent a few days there, some kind of conference he was going to, and he left. And when he left, the Tehran Times reported that another faction of the government, the Ayatollah, for example, was ticked off that he was there. There was some miscommunication, it appears, so far. The Tehran Times called him a U.S. senator, for example, and not just a state senator. DeBacchus says, hey, I was there as a private citizen. I wasn't, representing the state or anything like that. It's one of those flaps that at least DeBacchus was able to get out of the country. And also, I didn't see this in the Tehran Times yet, but they may not know that he's an openly gay senator as well, which being gay in Iran is, I think, actually can be a capital crime. So it's probably smart of him to leave before they figured it out.
Wow. That's just, and so a little bit of misunderstanding from the outset. In fact, calling it a secret trip to Tehran by a U.S. senator, misidentifying DeBacchus in the press there. Interesting story. And it won't go anywhere from here. It doesn't really have legs.
Yeah, I don't think Jim's going back to Iran anytime soon.
Okay. Well, we've come to that point where it's time now for our underplayed stories of the week. This is where we examine stories that maybe didn't get the coverage that that it could have gotten, or are just interesting other stories. And so I'm going to go to each of you. Robert Gerke, what's your underplayed story of the week this week?
Well, it's a series of stories that Lee Davidson has done on UTA and their transparency issues that they've been struggling with, I guess it's fair to say, over the past several months. In this case, there had been a flap a few months ago about them closing committees, saying that they don't have to do those in public, that they're not subject to the Open and Public Meetings Act. And so come to find out that they've continued to have these meetings and do them in the secret. Well, there was pressure brought to bear, and they said they were going to open these meetings up. Come to find out, they've continued to have these meetings in private, or have meetings in private, but they said they're not the committees. They've disbanded the committees. They're just groups of UTA board members meeting.
They're not actual meetings.
And they're not actual meetings. So they found a nice little way around it. This has brought some pressure from County Commissioner Richard Snellgrove, who's talking again about withholding the county's contribution to UTA. And again, it's this constant struggle with UTA trying, and the transparency issues and the secret versus secrecy. And there's been calls all along about withholding money to UTA, to restructuring the way their board is elected and appointed. And so I think this is something that, again, despite their efforts to try to right this ship, they've really had a hard time doing it.
Well, and the board right now is appointed and not elected, and there are calls to have it be elected.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating series of reports all in this past week from Lee Davidson. Check it out at sltrib.com. George Pyle, your underplayed story of the week.
The Tribune carried in print and on website is a couple of stories from the AP and the, I think it's the Center for Public Integrity, about the millions and millions of dollars that drug companies have been putting into state legislatures, including in Utah, to make sure that nobody stands between you and your opioid prescription. Millions of people are addicted to these. Since the turn of the century, they count 165,000 deaths from opioid overdoses nationwide. It's interesting, one, how much money is going into this. And what's also interesting as a journalist, the Center for Public Integrity is one of these new nonprofit investigative services that has sprung up as the for-profit journalism model seems to be in a lot of trouble. Hmm. But read those.
Interesting. No, very interesting reporting and, lobbying from Big Pharma. Matt Canham, your underplayed story of the week.
I'm going to go with a story from Zoe McGinn. This is about a suicide hotline effort in Utah. Representative Steve Eliason from Sandy asked an intern to call 19 crisis numbers in Utah. And when that intern did, only one person picked up the phone.
Wow.
So this is a problem in a state where suicide is much higher than in the majority of states. And we're seeing that both with young people and old people. So there's an effort pushed by Representative Eliason and Salt Lake County Councilwoman Amy Winder Newton to create a three-digit number that would work statewide.
Anywhere you were.
Anywhere you are, something like 311 is what they're thinking.
We're going to have to leave it there. Matt Canham, thank you very much for that. Tommy Burr, I'm sorry, we're not going to get to your underplayed story of the week right now. I'm just going to thank everybody for being here. Robert Gerke, Matt Canham, Thomas Burr, and George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for being here.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, he talks about his battle with advertisers. When you came home after serving an LDS mission, as is, I gather, typical, you had to have a sort of exit interview with the president of your stake, and he asked you some standard questions about your experience, among them, what you planned to do now that you were home. What was your plan after you got back from your mission?
My plan was, essentially didn't have one until the last few months of my mission. Most of my companions or the other missionaries were, I was going to go to school, I'm going to do this, I'm going to marry, you know, Angela.
Right.
They all had plans. I was essentially coming back to nothing because I left a group of friends I didn't want to connect with again. Hmm. And the only friends I had were the missionaries that I made friends with. And so I decided that I was going to live the life that I was used to, which was, you know, being in the military. I was going to go off and see the world. So I told my stake president that I was going to go to Texas and get a merchant marine license and ship out.
I know that was a worrying plan to your stake president, I take it.
Yeah, because in his mind, I think it didn't really lend itself well to continued church service. I mean,
right.
There's no churches or temples on boats.
In your words in the column, there wasn't a lot that he could do about it, though. And I know in the end you didn't end up going into the Merchant Marines, not because of the advice of your stake president, but because you ended up falling in love and you got married. Really, though, this column ends up being about how some post-mission exit interviews can be a bit more, I don't know if aggressive is the word, or maybe a bit more intrusive than yours was.
Yeah, Mormons, we're great on making plans and setting goals. I mean, we don't always accomplish them, obviously, but we're kind of a goal-oriented people. And you come out of your mission, you know, 2 years of setting goals, sometimes impossible goals. And so this stake in Utah County, they came up with which was essentially a contract where you'd agree to do this and this and this and this, you know, in order to maintain your testimony as a missionary and those sorts of things. And then there were places on it, and this is the part that really got me, for your bishop to sign, the stake president to sign, and your parents.
Right, and here you are, a grown person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're 21 years old, and not all the stuff that they wanted you to do in the contract may have been in your plans. I certainly wasn't going to sign up for LDS Institute you know, when I was going to go into the Merchant Marines.
Right, that wasn't going to happen. There's part of it that says that you should associate with sort of people of the same ilk as you are. Maybe.
Yeah, you know, they made you, or the contract obliged you to associate only with people who shared the same view of the gospel as you did. And you would only date those people and only associate with those kinds of people, which didn't make any sense considering that you just spent 2 years doing that.
Right.
You know, associating with people who didn't share your view of the world and encouraging them to try to adopt it, but...
In the end, this contract has been abandoned by this particular stake.
Yeah, once you pull something like that and out into the light, people start thinking, oh yeah, maybe that wasn't a very good idea. You get sort of what they're after. They're trying to help you stay connected to the church. There's a problem with returned missionaries becoming inactive.
This is reintegration after your experience.
Yeah, in sort of a way. My day, they just told you go to singles ward because they knew there's somebody, you know, want to marry you.
Yeah.
And that'd keep you closer to the church. But this was somebody trying to take it a step further to the point of a legalistic obligation.
It can be tough reintegrating after being away either as a missionary or however. What's the sort of advice to people who are going to have to try and help returned missionaries get back into the day-to-day life here back in the U.S.?
There's not really a lot of advice to give because everybody's an individual. The best thing you can do for anybody, whether they're your non-Mormon neighbor or your returned missionary that you feel spiritually responsible for, and that is to just accept them.
Right. Don't make them sign any contracts.
Don't make them sign any contracts. Don't treat them like they're a pariah if they make a mistake. And if they don't share your worldview, that's probably a healthy thing for you.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby talking about the experience of returned missionaries and not about advertisers. You can find all of his opinions at the Kirby archives at sltrib.com. That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and the Tribune's Emily Means. A quick reminder that here at KCPW, we are in our fall pledge drive. You can make a pledge of support by calling 801-359-5279 or going to kcpw.org to make a contribution there. We'll see you again next week. Thanks for tuning in.